Welcome to Big Blend Radio, where we celebrate variety and how it adds spice to quality of life.
Monarch butterflies, they migrate from Canada and America down to Mexico every fall, every year. Hundreds of millions of them. It is one of those amazing natural wonders to experience. However, the monarch butterfly is threatened by habitat loss, not just in America, but also going into Mexico. And today, February 5th, 2024, we are celebrating Western Monarch Butterfly Day. And, you know, this is important to think about, not just today, February 5th, 2024, but honestly, every day. These monarch butterflies are incredible. So they fly south and then they come back home to the States and a little portion of Canada every spring. And we're getting ready for that. But as I record this today, there's piles of snow outside. So I always think about them. How do they do this? Well, I went on to monarchwatch.org, and this is the incredible organization that created the Monarch Way Stations that really can get you to create a way station for monarchs to have the right food, shelter, water, etc., giving them a landing spot. And I was on their website, and Dr. Orly Arch, known as Chip Taylor, the founding director of Monarch Watch, provided some interesting facts for us. The migration. So yes, as I said, hundreds of millions of monarch butterflies migrate from eastern North America to Mexico each fall. They overwinter in the high elevation Oyamo fir forests of the transvolcanic range of central Mexico. They are unable to survive freezing temperatures, and so those breeding in temperate regions must escape to moderate climates to reproduce the next season. Most of the monarchs joining the migration each fall are 3 to 4 generations removed from those that made the journey the previous year. The migration actually begins in mid-August in the north and in September at the mid-latitudes, and it progresses at a pace of 25 to 30 miles per day, though individual butterflies often fly further during periods when conditions are favorable. Most monarchs originate from locations more than 1,500 linear miles from the overwintering sites. This is incredible. The duration of the migration appears to be 2 to 2.5 months. Amazing. Think about these butterflies. The monarch breeding areas in eastern North America are recolonized by 2 generations of monarchs, the overwintering butterflies that move north in the spring and their offspring, and then the latter reach maturity and begin flying north and northeast in late April, reaching the northern limits of milkweeds by mid-June. So milkweed is their food. This is a huge deal, and that's part of this Monarch Way Station program and many other programs we're going to talk about later. It's really about having milkweed, which is a native species, and there's certain, I mean, milkweed has all kinds of species in there, and it's about having the right milkweed. Some of it is invasive if it goes to the wrong area. So anyway, we have a lot of resources in our show notes, so click on them. We have podcasts with gardening experts, and we have a special podcast coming on after I finish up these facts. So let's get back to it. Longevity. Migratory monarchs survive the winter in Mexico. Those ones that go to Mexico are 8 to 9 months of age and may be the longest lived of all butterflies. Think of it. They only live 8 to 9 months, these poor babies. I want them to live forever. In contrast, reproductive monarchs breeding during the summer months, they only live 2 to 5 weeks due to the high cost of reproduction. So this is really, you know, you've got to think about their timing here. This is a short lifespan for these babies. Monarch populations are measured as the number of hectares. 1 hectare is 2.47 acres of trees. So they're looking at the number of trees because they cluster in the trees in mid-December of each year. The size of the population is varied from 2.19 to 18.2 hectares. Hectares over the last 2 decades, averaging close to 9 hectares in the 90s and between 5 to 6 hectares in this decade. So the threats. that's the thing. That is why today is so important and that we look at conservation of them. During the breeding season, monarchs require milkweed plants upon which to rear their larvae and nectar sources to sustain the adults during reproduction. Nectar sources are also required by the butterflies to fuel the fall migration to Mexico as well as the spring flights northward. So they're going back and forth. Overwintering monarchs require shelter and water, and that's where we can help. We can be like the hotels for the butterflies, basically. All of these resources are diminishing, and deforestation at the overwintering sites in Mexico has eliminated a number of former colony sites, and others have been badly degraded so as to reduce the shelter and water available to wintering butterflies. So Mexico's been deforesting. We have pesticides and all these things happening that hurt the actual habitat for these butterflies. So that's, again, how we have to all work together. There's a conservation program that all three countries have to get together, and they're working on it, USA, Canada, and Mexico. So this is all a Northern American issue that we can get together on. So there is a North American Monarch Conservation Plan that is, it's a program that is being worked on to help everyone. So we're going to go, we talked about the deforestation in Mexico a little bit here, but in the United States, 6,000 acres are converted to development each day. Think about it, 6,000 acres every single day are being developed. And that eliminates the milkweeds needed by the monarchs and the monarch larvae and the nectar sources required by the adult monarchs. So that's why planting milkweed and the native milkweed, the right milkweed in your area, is so important. So we're talking about conservation. So at the end of this segment, we went into our Nature Big Blend Radio Nature Connection archives, and we're going to re-air our interview with Sarah Dykeman. She talks about her book, Bicycling with Butterflies, My 10,201-Mile Journey Following the Monarch Migration. It recounts her inspirational ride alongside the monarchs as she follows unmapped roads in Michoacán, Mexico, through the United States and into Ontario, Canada, and back again to Mexico. And you can learn more. She's got a great organization. She's doing amazing things for monarch butterflies if you go to her website, beyondabook.org. And so all of that, again, is listed and linked in the show notes. I do want to thank our friend Margo Carrera, who's been a part of our Nature Connection shows. She's a fine art nature photographer, and I encourage you to go to her website, margocarrera.etsy.com. All that, again, in the show notes. So when we look at conservation, it's about it, and you can become an actual monarch way station in your garden. So check out monarchwatch.org. They are incredible. You can do it in your backyard. If you're in a community garden, you can do it. We need to look at locally in our local parks, our community parks, our schools. I even know resorts that even are part of the Monarch Way Station. Ventana Canyon up in Tucson, they really have this amazing desert botanical garden in their resort, and they are a Monarch Way Station. A lot of botanical gardens are Monarch Way Stations as well. So wherever we can do it, it's important. National Wildlife Federation has a certified backyard wildlife gardening for wildlife habitat program, and a lot of bed and breakfasts do it. We have podcasts on that where it's basically creating a pollinator garden. So in the show notes, I have some links to garden experts. We've got Kim Ironman, who's got the Pollinator Victory Garden, is her book. We've also got Nancy Lawson, the Humane Gardener. They're all about creating the ecosystems and bringing them back so they work in together. And that's bringing back the monarch butterflies as well. There's also Stephanie Rose with the Regenerative Garden. And recently we did an interview with Adrian Edwards and Rachel Schleiger about their book, Firescaping Your Home, A Manual for Readiness in Wildfire Country. You're talking about California, Colorado, all these wildfires that have been happening, especially in the West, even Canada. That affects our monarchs as well. But by planting the correct native species, your habitat will be more resilient to fires. So they talk about that in their book and on the interview, and they actually talk about milkweed as well. So there's that book, as well as for kids, Amy Stark Her book is The Fairy Godmother Who Helps the Monarch. So I've got links to everybody, as well as Dr. Doug Tallamy. He took his book, Nature's Best Hope, and created one just for young readers, where he encourages young readers to get out and use their backyard to create their own national park. So in other words, you're going to create a garden together with your family and put in the native plants, so you attract these species like monarch butterflies, hummingbirds, local birds. You know, the native plants are really the key thing, but milkweed is huge for just about everybody. And milkweed really helps the monarchs. So again, I think the most important resource out of everything is monarchwatch.org. Some really cool things Nancy and I have seen as we travel the country in our Love Your Parks tour is the National Wildlife Refuges really do a really huge thing in creating monarch way stations and doing things about bringing pollinators back by, you know, one good example is Buenos Aires National Wildlife Refuge south of Tucson, Arizona. They were getting rid of invasive species and bringing back in the forbs and the ripe plants. They have actually like a short grass prairie, and they have pronghorn and the bobwhite quail. And so by doing this and bringing back some of the actual milkweed, and the milkweed's going to be different there than it is in Colorado, different than in the East. In fact, there's milkweed. I remember in Tucson when we lived there, there was milkweed vines. That all helps the butterflies as well. But it was really cool to see this landscape change that from being a ranch that ended up having all these invasives in there, having this habitat be restored and the wildlife does come back. Restoration works, and this is one of those environments. So wildlife refuges do a great job, and it's a great place to take kids. So do our national parks and public lands, our state parks. So I encourage to take kids out and get involved. One thing I also wanted to talk about was the Lake Lure Flowering Bridge. So this is a new thing that is starting to happen in communities across the country, where these old bridges are just getting torn down. And then master gardeners are getting together and saying, heck no, you're not taking down our old bridge. We're going to make a garden out of it. And the Lake Lure Flowering Bridge is in North Carolina, just outside Asheville, and actually right outside Chimney Rock, which is a state park. And they dedicated this bridge as a flowering bridge on October 19th, 2013. And it is also a National Wildlife Federation certified wildlife habitat and a certified monarch way station that I was talking about through Monarch Watch, and a destination on the Rosalind Carter Butterfly Trail and the Appalachian Mural Trail. It's open year-round, and it's free to visit, and it's wheelchair accessible. These bridges create, I mean, it's amazing what you can do with what would be deemed dead space or brown space. I'm even thinking about the rail yard park out in Santa Fe, New Mexico that we went to, that took a brown space and put in native plants and even orchards so people could get food. And they also used the indigenous people's way of gardening with waffle gardens and water conservation. And they took this brown space. Think about the toxins that come from a rail yard, right? And it thrives. I have a huge rose garden, but butterflies, they have the native plants and the right milkweed. So having the correct milkweed is very important. So the other thing we saw, you know, as we travel the country, we end up going to rest areas and parks. And I'm going to say the Midwest kicks some butt when it comes to planting milkweed. And they really have to, because of the agriculture and the pesticides used in agriculture. They realized, oh, we've got to fix this. And they've been doing it. And at a lot of rest areas in Missouri, Indiana, I mean, Iowa, Minnesota, you will see actual monarch gardens, monarch way stations in a rest area. You pull over on the side of the rest area, you want to go to the bathroom, stretch your legs, get a drink, you know, a soda kind of thing. Go to a vending machine is what I'm talking about. No drinking and driving here. And they have gardens, actual pollinator gardens. So they're educating us all as the public, but they're actually taking their highways and going, hey, we can't have a dead space. And so it's really, really cool. So there is an actual monarch highway. And we found out that we were on it as we traveled the Jefferson Highway. The Jefferson Highway is a historic road that goes from Winnipeg, Canada, down to New Orleans, in Louisiana. And part of it is an actual monarch highway. It really is a migration. It follows the migration corridor for the actual monarch butterflies. Follows Interstate 35 from Laredo, Texas to Duluth, Minnesota. So it's really the central flyway of the eastern migratory population of the monarch butterfly. It's a partnership effort that brings people together to conserve the actual habitat for these butterflies. It's not just on the roadsides, it's in people's gardens. It's about this whole area, not just on I-35, but it's about spreading out in homes, in gardens, in farmlands, corporate areas that have industrial parks, that have some green space, put in milkweed. So it is a really cool program. So that website is monarchjoinventure.org. Again, everything will be in the show notes for you. And speaking of fun facts on monarchs, I also have a link to the U.S. Forest Service, who gives a really cool list of fun facts about monarch butterflies. They talk about, you know, the species. They talk about, like, you know, the locations of where you can find them. They tell you the difference between a monarch and a viceroy butterfly, which they look so similar that you may be thinking you're photographing a monarch and it will actually be a viceroy. They talk about what they eat, the wildflowers that they consume and enjoy. So I'm going to put that in the show notes too, especially for those of you who like to travel into national forest areas. Trees are a big deal for these. They like to cluster for the monarchs. So that's also a big deal. So anyway, here we go. We're going to go into our interview with Sarah Dykeman, talking about her book and her adventures. Really, it's pretty amazing her book, Bicycling with Butterflies Again, My 10,201-Mile Journey Following the Monarch Migration. So take a listen to that. Again, everything is in the show notes. Thank you for joining us here on Big Blend Radio. Right, everybody. Our first guest on today's Big Blend Radio Nature Connection show here in California, Sequoia Country in Porterville, California, is Sarah Dykeman. She is the founder of BeyondABook.org, and she's the author. She just totally rocks. She's the author of Bicycling with Butterflies, My 10,201-Mile Journey Following the Monarch Migration. So welcome, Sarah. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on today.
Hey, we're excited about it. Nancy's been digging into your book and telling me all these kinds of stories and tales, and says, you know, really connected with nature. But I think really also, I just got to give a shout out. You've got so many accolades coming in. Jane Goodall, you got an email from Jane Goodall, like my hero.
Yes, I definitely jumped up and down when I got an email from her and her little blurb expressing how important we telling stories about the monarchs is was just very, oh, that was a good email.
That's awesome.
That's a reason awesome. To celebrate. What led you to decide to get on a bicycle and, you know, and cycle the migration? Because that goes through Mexico all the way up through the Rockies. I mean, that's quite a route. What led you to do that?
I love animals. In fact, when in your introduction, you were talking about the Sierra. I spend most of my summers in the mountains counting tadpoles, and I've spent the last five summers or so in the Sierra counting tadpoles. And I start that back up in June, so I'm super excited. But I love animals, and I think each animal has a story to tell, and the way that we're going to give them voice and to get people excited about taking care of them is to tell their stories. And so I decided, well, I'm going to ride my bike with the monarch, and I'm going to learn as much as I can about the monarch. And along the way, I'm going to be their voice, and I'm going to tell their story, and I'm going to get people excited. And there's a lot of different roles that stewards and conservationists need to take to tackle all the problems that we're facing and all the challenges that there are. And for me, I think my role is to make conservation fun and exciting, and to just remind people that in their own backyards are these incredible travelers. So you're a traveler, I'm a traveler, but like for folks that can't do that, well, the travelers can come to them, and they can plant gardens in their yard, and they can invite these epic migrants to visit and be part of the adventure in that way.
I love that. I love that. Mm-hmm. I think that's really right about it being fun. And, you know, at one point, it's like if anybody has any more finger pointing, they're just going to shut down. And especially for our youth, to get our youth involved. And that's something I know you, as you were cycling around, you spent time with kids and going to schools. What was that like? I mean, they must have, did they look at your bike or like go, what are you doing? And did you get outside with them with butterflies?
I did. I did all of the above. So I've done other adventures, and it was important to me to share my experiences and my stories with kids, because I feel so lucky that I can take the time to do these things. And I wanted to share with kids that, like, I'm a normal person, and you don't have to be like the best or the brightest or the smartest or the bravest or any of that. You just need to like have an idea and go with it. And so I actually talked to almost 9,000 kids on my butterfly trip. And I just love talking with kids. They're so excited about the world. They are full of hope and possibility, and they have the best questions. And I'm reminded of, after one presentation, this little girl came up to me, and we're just like, I'm packing up my stuff. I'm putting my tent back in. I always would get my tent out, and we'd see how many kids we could fit in it. I mean, I think my record was like 15 kindergartners. So it's like, look, my house is actually quite big. I could fit 15 of you in it. But this little girl came up to me after as I'm packing up, and she just looks at me and she just goes, is any of this real? And I just loved it, because that's what we need, right? Is we need to like show kids that like it doesn't have to be what you've heard of before. It doesn't have to be something that other people do. Like, you just have to go do it. And just because it hasn't been done doesn't mean it's not possible. So,
oh,
yeah,
I
it is
that.
Real.
Yeah, it is. Well, also, I think that right now, you know, the whole COVID thing and, you know, looking at climate change, I think there's fear for young kids. I think there's a scary element for them. It's like, what's my life going to look like? You know, and to make it fun, it makes it attainable. When something's fun, you know you can go out and do it. You know, it's like, okay, let's rock this, you know. So I really like that part, that keeping it fun. Nancy, you really got into this. You've been giving me book reports like every 5 minutes.
Well, there's so much in it. And I know all different, there's different butterflies, and they're probably all different as far as lifespan and what they eat. But it cleared up a lot of things that I was taught. Like, I remember being taught that butterflies only live 1 to 2 days. And now I know that that's not true. And they only, they go from flower to flower to flower. And maybe that's not so true either. Like, it seems to me that the monarchs really, really just want milkweed. They don't really want any other plants. Is that so?
Well, it's partially so. So the monarch females, when they are looking for plants to lay their eggs on, they are exclusively looking for milkweed. And for folks that don't know, milkweed is the only plant that the monarch caterpillar can eat. And they are it's a plant that's toxic to most herbivores, and it has like this milky latex sap that's really sticky. But the monarchs have adapted to be able to eat the milkweed and actually sequester the toxic chemicals in their body, thus rendering them toxic. And that's why monarchs are bright orange. It's warning potential predators, hey, I'm not a tasty meal. You should avoid me.
Leave me alone.
But the monarch adults, they are actually looking for lots of flowers for nectar. Mm. So they're pretty opportunistic, and they'll nectar on any flowers they get. And that's especially important on the fall migration. So if you live on the route of the monarch in the fall, they're not laying eggs in the fall, but they are trying to fuel up. And monarchs are one of the few migrants that arrives to their destination fatter than when they start. And that's because as they're traveling south to Mexico, to the forest, they're eating as much as they are, excuse me, they're drinking as much nectar as they can. And then they get to Mexico, and it's just such this amazing phenomenon. They'll actually cluster in the branches of the trees in Mexico at about 10,000 feet above sea level, where it's pretty cold. because they're cold-blooded, they'll remain inactive, and they'll actually live off their fat reserves for most of the winter. So there's just all these little secrets. And, you know, it's like one of the things is, like, the more I pedaled with them, the more I learned about them, just the more amazed I was and the more I fell in love with the monarch.
Oh. It's interesting when you talk about migration. When I remember driving from Tucson, I was going to Joshua Tree, yeah, and I was taking more of the roads that are closer to the border areas. And it's really beautiful. It's actually following the Juan Bautista de Anza National Historic Trail on these areas. And there was a caterpillar migration. They were crossing over the road everywhere. And I was like, this is amazing. I was filming them. I'm like, they're all on this. I didn't know caterpillars did that. I see it with tarantulas and, you know, other, you know, cool bugs. But I did not know caterpillars did that.
Well, that's something that you notice things like that, especially when you're on a bike or when you're walking, because you have to really slow down. And what I noticed on my bike tour is that every species is a little different, right? And I would notice certain caterpillars were always crossing the road. I was noticing like the tent caterpillars crossing the road. But on my entire 10,000 mile trip, I only saw two monarch caterpillars crossing the road. And I think what it is monarchs will feed on milkweed, and then they will leave the milkweed to find a spot to make their chrysalis. I don't think they're on the move quite like other species. And so I love that. I love how you get to know animals by just really paying attention. And I saw so many monarch caterpillars. Like, I got so good at it, not to brag, but I could, like, spot a monarch caterpillar going 10 miles an hour. I'd often look for, like, on the milkweed, wherever the monarch will chew, there'll be, like, that white latex sap will kind of ooze out, and it'll form these, like, horseshoe-shaped white marks on the milkweed. And I'd see one of those, and I'd slam on my brakes, and then I'd dive into the ditches. And there's so much happening along the roads. And I think, like you said, like, making those observations is really just kind of connects you to the world, and it leaves you with a lot more questions than answers.
I know. It's so cool. When we did our trip into Sequoia National Park the other day, we went with the naturalist, Rebecca Jones, and she was awesome, because we were just taking it really slow through the giant forest, and that way we could see all the bugs. And the first thing we did see was a caterpillar, actually. It was like,
true.
I love them. It was so cool. They was like, doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. Anyway, through the bushes, you know. And I'm like that about spiders, all of it. I'm into the bug world. Because I think that they're often feared. Butterflies are like, oh, they're pretty, you know, that's great. But I think we've got to look at how important these species are. I remember doing a thing on butterflies and realizing that if we took down this one yucca type of plant, one yucca species, that one butterfly, one moth, specific moth species, would lose all of its food because it only had to have that species. And from there, it does circle back to us, doesn't it? I mean, when you think about it, we're all connected in the web of life, and butterflies are part of it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's one of the things I love most about the monarch is I actually call them gateway bugs, because you're right. It's easy to fall in love with a butterfly, especially a bright orange, beautiful one. The monarch is pretty easy to recognize. They're like kind of floppy flyers. They don't just like zoom by, so you can get good looks at them. But what I notice is that you fall in love with the adult, and then you're like, oh, I want to learn more. So you learn about the caterpillars. So you really start getting in the weeds, and you're crawling around, and you discover not just the caterpillars, but you discover the spiders. And I think when you really start to look, I always say people look, but they don't see. When you start to really look and actually see all the creatures, you see their beauty. You see that every creature is worth noticing and worth celebrating and worth protecting and giving habitat to.
Absolutely.
And I think they all have a place and they're part of a cycle that has to stay the same. You remove one species and it's going to affect, even though we at this point probably don't know how certain species, if they go away, affect us, I'm pretty sure there's going to be an effect. You know, we just studied. Yeah, we haven't studied long enough for all of the species to know what the effect really is going to be.
Yes. And I think we're learning that, you know, the news is kind of depressing and we're learning all those things. But that's another thing about the monarch that's so great is like when you protect the monarch, you are protecting so many other plants and animals. And it doesn't need to be the monarch. It can be whatever species really just calls to you. And if you set aside land, set aside space on your land, in your front yard, in your backyard, wherever that may be, to help that species that you're drawn to, you're going to help the monarch. You're going to help the caterpillars that you don't know the names of. You're going to help the entire planet. And that's a really beautiful lesson that we all need to learn.
I love what you say about that, because the gardens, if in planting native plants, National Wildlife Federation has that wonderful program where you can become a certified backyard habitat. And it's like watching wildlife. You know, you can plant
that's
something
cool.
That's correct for the, it's basically don't, it's, we need to look at our backyards as not being part of the dead zone. You know, we look at dead zones in the ocean, but we're doing it by sometimes planting the wrong plants or, you know, having water sources for, you know, put you can put like sponges and water together and butterflies will come and puddle. You know, there's all kinds of cool things you can do in your backyard. And they're so nice to watch. Birds, everybody will come in and you'll have a whole ecosystem. It's something we've noticed, and I know, Sarah, that you hang out in rest areas and wildlife refuges like we do, and some of the rest areas, I want to start a map of rest areas across the country, because some of them have got memorials, but some of them, there seems to be some program where they're doing pollinator gardens at these rest areas, which I think is pretty cool, because when you get these big highways and everything, a lot of the land just gets ruined on the side of the road, of the highways. It becomes kind of toxic. So by doing these gardens, does that help kind of mitigate what's going on in the roadway?
It does. And there's actually quite a few programs happening to create corridors for monarchs and other pollinators. There's the Monarch Highway program that they're trying to get off the ground that spans the I-35 corridor that runs through the Midwest. There's actually legislation right now to help support municipalities to plant natives. And it's totally true. Like if you ride your bike across the United States or even drive or whatever, however it is that you're traveling, you are going to just start, if you start to look at all the places that are wasted space, it'll drive you nuts. I honestly got kind of mad on the trip, and I definitely had an anger in me because I was seeing the world through the eyes of the monarch, and I saw just so much green grass, and it's like, we have to water that and fertilize that and put chemicals
so
on it. And for what? We've decided
so
that's beautiful. But we just have to have a paradigm shift.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we think that's beautiful, and we're trying to be good neighbors, and we're trying to be a good neighbor. And what I want people to realize, and I hope that my book showcases, is that we have to be good neighbors to the more than human creatures. So we have to be good neighbors to monarchs and to the bees and to the birds. And to do that, you take out the grass and you replace it with natives. And if you can do that on the roadside, you can do that in your yard. And when you do that, it's win-win, because not only are you going to have an adventure and get all these beautiful creatures visiting you, but you're also going to save a lot of money on watering. You're going to help filter the water. You're going to help carbon sequester. And you're going to not have to spend your entire summer mowing. So start small. If it's a little scary, start small. And then I think the best way is just every year add a little bit more. And in doing so, you'll be an example that your neighbors will see. And that slowly we can make a paradigm shift and see a little bit wilder yard as what is actually beautiful.
Mm.
They are
about that,
way
Nancy.
More beautiful. They really are. You know, I mean, because you get all these different kind of flowers and different plants and trees. It's far more interesting. You get way more birds that way too, and butterflies and other insects. It's so much more interesting than this flat green grass.
And you get color.
Yeah, we actually know a person who pulled out her lawn, and then she went and put AstroTurf down in the backyard. And it's like, What is with this big flat green look? I understand it for football fields or something.
Rant coming up.
You know, but I don't understand really. It isn't because of the maintenance, because it is more maintenance. I don't know what it is that makes us think that that's pretty.
Yeah, we were sold on that idea, and people
yeah.
are changing. There is some incredible movements out there to like you said, like the waystation programs to bring and share nature. And like you said, it's not just national parks. If we rely on national parks and wildlife refuges to be the last stronghold to save all the creatures on the planet, we will fail.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
that's impossible. And we have to learn that we are part of nature. Yeah.
I want hotels and office buildings and places like that, and more like we started only documenting national park units, and then we quickly learned, and we changed the name of our tour and everything, the Love Your Parks tour, that every single park matters. They're saying that even just for quality of life for a family, that every family needs to have a park within 10 miles from them, so that they can keep up with their health, and whether it's mindfulness or meditation or just fresh air, but it could be exercise or walking. But if we could get more parks and public lands, but even the business world adopted this idea of having, way stations out in their gardens and planting native plants, it will save them money on water. But places that people go to all the time, I think that would be really great, because like the highway program, people know about, pollinator gardens, just because they're stopping to go to the rest area, they see a pollinator garden, like, oh, look at all the butterflies. Oh, how pretty is this? Oh, we should do that at home. So that's why I want more corporate people to do it. Bed and breakfast, all of that. And a lot of bed and breakfasts are doing that, actually. We've stayed in a lot of bed and breakfasts, and they're starting to do the native plant thing. And so the more we do, the better, and more people like you. But listen, I know that you slept in wildlife refuges, but you've slept in people's homes. How did that even come around? Did people see you on the bicycle and say, hey, do you need a place to sleep? What's going on with that?
Yes, all of the above. I didn't have a really set schedule when I set off, and that was purposeful, because if I didn't know where I was going to be most days, most nights, then that gave me the time and space to say yes when I received invitation. And one of my rules bike touring is as long as I feel safe, always say yes to opportunity, always say yes to invitation. And so I would meet people at grocery stores, and they'd say, hey, do you want to come to my house? And I would say yes. And the other thing is, there is this incredible network of people taking care of the monarch, and they are dedicated and passionate and strong. And I underestimated how incredible they were when I first started. But what happened is one person would find out, and they would tell their friends and their network. And then all of a sudden I'd get all these other emails. And, it came to the point where I'd have to look at a map and be like, I can't add 300 miles to my trip because I'm running out of time and my legs are tired. But if they were even kind of close, like I wouldn't hesitate to add 50 miles most of the time to visit someone who had energy to help the monarch, because what happened is I realized that was also bonding me to the monarch, right? The experience of like the same people helping the monarch were helping me. And in that way, our trips were really similar.
I love that, because with you going around, I mean, it happens with us too. It's like this interesting thing happens. I feel like we're having conversations on it's not like, okay, you're on the show, all these people are going to hear you, but there's something to just having these personal one-on-one conversations with people about a cause that you care about. I mean, almost feel like we fuel our energy to do that and to touch as many more people as we can by being just that one-on-one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I have like a total cheesy metaphor that I love, and it gets me through the day, and I think about it. When I was in Mexico, the monarchs cling from the branches, and they're inactive most of the year. But then when the sun comes out, they'll actually start flying about. And if it's just one, you can't hear them. But when there's thousands, it becomes this like beautiful humming song. And it's just so spectacular. And I spent hours just with my eyes closed listening to the sound of butterfly wings. And I think, wow, that's such a perfect metaphor for all of our conservation efforts, because my voice alone would just be, a voice. But when you're talking on behalf of nature and I am, and then all the people we reach share their stories and their passion and their voice, well, all of a sudden a lot of people are talking. And that's a voice that's loud and can't be ignored.
Everyone's talking. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And we've got to, you know, stand up for issues of, you know, stand up and sign those petitions and call people, make those calls, make those conversations happen, even on a local level, right? When, if you want something to happen, you walk into to your city council and say something, you know, call your mayor and say, hey, I want, you know, a Monarch Way station in the park, you know, the parks and rec.
Yeah.
The more native plants you have, the cheaper it is on water. It really is.
Exactly. True. And there's actually even, there's the Monarch's Mayor Pledge that you can talk to your mayor about doing a few things to help put your town on the map and pledge your support to the Monarch with action.
Ooh, I like that. Mm. Now I want to go travel according to butterflies.
Well, yeah. But, you know, it is funny when you think about, maybe funny is not the right word, odd, that we, like, we have three states we've been through just very recently, New Mexico, Arizona, and California, who are all suffering from a drought, but they got green lawns. So, mm-hmm. you know, so all that extra effort to have a lawn, when you find yourself in need of water, perhaps mm-hmm. if we didn't have so many lawns, we would have more water, you think? Possibly?
For sure. I don't know if this is, this, don't quote me on this, but I saw, because I'm in California, I saw a poster and it was like, per square foot, a lawn uses more water than a swimming pool.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know if that's like site specific to where I was. That was on the east side of the Sierra, which is very dry, but the point being is we have to prioritize. We have a limited amount of space and we have a limited amount of water and how are we going to use that? And quite frankly, it can be put to use. I'd rather drink water than water some grass, that, especially when there's not even kids playing on it or a football game, like you were saying. Like there is room to have both. But right now we're choosing just grass in so many occasions.
Yeah.
And we have to learn to share.
Yeah. I think the one thing you can do, it's like if you have kids and a dog and you want to have a play area, just have a play area with that patch of grass. You don't need the whole lawn, you know. Or you have one, you know, like if you have the field, and if you have a field, you know, a park with a nice grassy area, then that's what everybody uses. You know, that's why I think communities coming together, we can utilize one lawn instead of, you know, each of us having our own lawn, is my point. And that way, a community is even stronger together. They start playing together and doing things together more. So I think there's a lot of solutions, and it's, we can blur the lines of all this, all that, or no, none of this, all of that, you know. I think we can blur the lines and
exactly.
kind of start compromising is the first step. So are you going to do another journey like this?
Well, I would love to. I've done a lot of other trips. I've done canoeing and walking mm-hmm. trips in the United States and lots of biking. I think I've gone about 80,000 miles on my bike. And so I would love to keep making adventures happen. Right now the book is the adventure. And I love the idea that the Monarch led me on the bike ride. And now the Monarch is leading me down this book adventure. And we'll see where the path goes.
Mm. Well, I'm going to start reading it too. Nancy's pretty much told me every word. She's all, and this happened, and that happened, you know. So it's also a travel story, you know. There's the mm-hmm. Monarch, but it's also an adventure story, you know, as well, which is exciting. Everyone needs to talk.
Right. People would see me in New York, and they'd say, "You're going to bike to Mexico?" And I'd be like,
"Yeah."
Well, yeah, but look, there's that little caterpillar right there in your yard. That caterpillar might fly to Mexico, or at least its kids might. That's also awesome. And so I hope to add a human element, a human scale to the story to just showcase how brilliant these animals are.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for joining us. So everyone, the book is out now by Sarah Dykeman, and it's S-A-R-A. And Dykeman, Sarah Dykeman. It's called Bicycling with Butterflies, My 10,201 Mile Journey Following the Monarch Migration. You can go to beyondabook.org. So that's a nonprofit that you have, right?
It's a more like a website. It's not technically a nonprofit, but I do not make a profit from it. And it's just sort of my
hub.
Umbrella. Mm. Yeah, it's a hub for my educational trips and to kind of just a one-stop shop to learn about adventure and all the great things in the world that are worth stopping to look at.
Thank you for listening to Big Blend Radio. Keep up with our shows at bigblendradio.com.